since every focus of our life seems to be directed towards finding happiness, then making sure that the direction that you have taken your life to produces the required result or the aspired result. And so the problem happens is where we seem to all want that happiness, but not really aware of all the causes and conditions that we are creating that may not necessarily be producing the same kind of wanted result. So that brings us to simple things. Simple question is, what impedes happiness? What is it that is not allowing us to find what we desperately seek? Our negative causes and conditions. But blinded by our own false understanding of things as they are, not really knowing the nature of things, not really knowing the reality of appearances of different things, the phenomena, the outer phenomena, nor having a clearer understanding of the true nature of the inner phenomena, we often live upon a belief that is nothing but assumptions. And so we assume a lot. And that assumption leads us to sustaining numerous causes and conditions, projecting numerous causes and conditions that are actually an impediment to the happiness that we are for a lifelong seeking all the time. And so, if human beings could eliminate those causes and conditions from their life that are going to bring about pain and suffering to self and the others, are self-destructive and destructive to the others, there would be no need for religion. First thing to throw out would be Buddhism. There's no need. I always say it's ironical. Just now I met a gentleman outside filling a form to come in. Seems quite a big, extensive form that you have to fill. And I was joking with him, I don't know, where is he? Did he make it inside the room or not? Yes, he did. Yes. So I was jokingly, because this is in my mind, isn't it? It's very expensive to be kind these days, or to learn how to be kind, at least, isn't it? The irony, the biggest slap on our ego is actually the forms. I don't know about other religion, but Buddhist forms. Sometimes it strikes me is, why do we have to do this? Why do I have to sit here in the first place? Why do you have to sit there to learn how to be kind? Could we not, if we are able to build something like the Bay Bridge, could we not also learn to be kind a little simpler way? Isn't it? So there's a whole fuss. I have to come from India. An evening like this has to be put together by no one else but Carl Castro. I need an efficient secretary like Jigme to actually organize this. Then Shambhala Center, San Francisco. You've had numerous meetings, I'm sure, isn't it? So then we have to fly all the way here. You have to make time ahead in advance. Then there's this registration. Then it doesn't fit in that room, so we have to all be at this Baha'i Center here. Then you have to go and fill that form down there, and I don't know what it costs. But, you know, I saw his credit card out there. And then what are we going to talk about? You be kind, I be kind. What we are pointing out to is, this is how we fool ourselves. When the Buddha called ignorance as the cause that deludes what is a natural human potential, he didn't point out to monstrous demons that impeded the possibility to realizing our own potentials. Those that impede our potentials are beautiful, often by human beings referred to as being necessary. All things are necessary. But on the other hand, the necessity does complicate things, and often we get more bewildered and struck and attracted by forms than the actual core essence of the teachings. So it's crucial, very important, that one understands this clearly, understands what the Buddha meant when he talked about deluded concepts. Deluded concepts, as I was saying, are not intentionally created and placed to impede and to obstruct realizing the fundamental true nature of one's own mind. These just become so very important because we refuse to see what is simple. And we are always persuaded by things that we have somehow assumed to be very important. There is no logical reasoning that can clearly explain why we have made all of these deluded concepts so very important. They just are there. And we believe them. We believe so strongly in the need, sort of necessity, and the importance of all these concepts. And we sustain them without ever challenging, without ever questioning them. So, first thing that we can say is anger. And we think it is important. How many of us have struggled with anger and irritation, disappointment, anxiousness, restlessness, doubt, hesitation, criticism, cynicism, fear? All different forms of what is very conveniently simply called anger. Some people suffer from abject anger. Most of us may not have anger as such as a gross emotion, but the subtle shades of anger in the form of sadness, in the form of fear, in the form of restlessness, in the form of constantly struggling, similar to the classic example of a person who may not know how to swim, grabbing on water, although you know that you cannot hold on to water, but the action, the reflexive, impulse action is to grab the water out of fear. Likewise, not knowing one's own true nature, we grab at whatever sensations, whatever feelings comes by. And so not knowing how to respond to something that is in contradiction and challenging the self, we will fall into the habit of the impulse of grabbing into any one thought that arises, whether that is restlessness, whether that is anxiousness, whether that is fear, whether that comes up as just gross aggression or impatient anger. And so we keep on thinking, doing it once, doing it twice, but when a lifetime of responding to that without questioning it, without challenging it, continuously is done, it is something we begin to then believe is necessary. And so this is how we live our life, thinking anger is very important. If I don't have that anger, maybe somebody will take advantage of me. In that simple line of saying, anger is important, and the second line, because it protects me, you're actually beginning to posit your belief in a lot of things, which in most times we don't even know what we are saying. We do not know really what is anger. We really do not know what this anger is trying to protect. We never question, ultimately, whom are you trying to protect? We just say me. It never occurs to us to say, beyond the English alphabets of M and E, what is it that you're actually looking at? But there is a supposition that yes, there is something there. Sometimes it seems to be in the head, sometimes it seems to be in the toe, sometimes it seems to be somewhere in the body, sometimes it seems to be somewhere out there. I don't know what it is, but I'm going to call that me. And we sustain that understanding without exploring that. And as the Buddha said, is that not only do you sustain it, and if that sustaining of the me or the idea of self was alone and independent, nothing to do with the others, that it did not impact somebody else, and somebody else could not impact it, then it was okay. like a person marooned on an island. If you lived by your own self, with your own me, then less problems. But here we are, let loose in society, 24 hours a day. And everyone continuously projecting their own me's, defending their own me's, and then serving the ambition and the demands and the expectation of this me, consequently produces a rhythm of life that is producing tremendous animosity and tremendous greed. And the impact of that, the result of that, is experienced by no one else but our own selves. And so therefore, the immense profoundness of the teachings of Mahayana, which always begins with everyone wants happiness, nobody wants suffering, must be understood carefully. Sometimes I think we repeat this phrase so much that perhaps very oftentimes we think we know what it means, but the impact of it doesn't really, or we do not really let it strike our own heart. And because we do not let it strike our own heart, we know and we believe in a philosophy that we do not necessarily actualize and embody. So in that way, today, if somebody were to say Mahayana path of bodhisattvahood, there are lots of things that you already probably know and practice, of the habitual patterns and the impulses that sustain only a supposition and not the authentic nature, not knowing the true nature. So the simple question would be is, in the decisions that you make in life, what is predominant? Is the reality of things as they are, the view, more predominant in the decisions you make? Or your decisions are still dominated by the suppositions that there is a me that has to be cared for and sustained? If through years of meditation and practice, still the predominant sort of message that is being brought up is from a base that truly is overpowered by the ego's belief of its own existence, then one is coming to a point where what I refer to is increased religiosity, increased adherence to a view, but not necessarily a Buddhist practitioner. True Buddhist practitioner considers form to be important. For example, let's say the shrine is a very important aspect in the Buddhist tradition of meditation. But is it the first and the most important thing? It is not. That shrine, or this form, or the readings, or the meditations, different kinds of meditations, are all methods or post-its, if you call it. That might be probably better. The job of the post-it is to remind you things that you have on the fridge, what is called fridge magnet, something like that. So that by looking at it, you are able to evoke the awareness of your own natural capacity to develop awakeness. And awakeness is not a sort of a fantastic, supernatural kind of a mystical thing. It's the same common sense. And I always say the same common sense that I would have when getting down the stairs over here. When I get up at the end of a session, do I go down the left-hand side where there are the stairs down the throne? Or do I go down the right-hand side from where the table is? How do I make the distinction? And there's no great enlightenment happening here. There's a common sense that says these are the stairs and this is a table. That common sense. And if you like it to be very Buddhist, you call it prajna, wisdom. Then if you want to make it even more complicated, call it sort of shera, more Tibetan. And there are many honorific terms, Buddha nature, enlightenment, whatever it is. Simple fact is, there is the potential, inner natural potential to discern. And the question is, how often do you use it? Where it is not utilized, then you are dependent upon all the post-its, the reminders, the methods, the teachers, the teachings, the readings, the sittings, and so forth. Where the familiarization with that basic fundamental wisdom that can be aware and discern between what are the causes that can lead to harm to your own self and eliminating that. And then looking at all those causes and conditions that are constructive, that are positive, that are good for you, being able to encourage yourself to maintain a continuum of those causes and conditions. That is the path of practice. That is how one should relate to the path of practice. So now, when that is not done, then often, as I said, one forgets the first motivating inspirations that one has cultivated, and one learns a lot of information. And the information and the knowledge of Dharma, knowledge of meditation and Buddhism, on the one hand, without knowledge, we say, one cannot really refine the primordial nature of the primordial wisdom. The wisdom needs to be made pure and ever-present and be able to really retain its authentic nature through the assistance or the support of knowledge. But on the other hand, when you relate to knowledge, not to really strengthen the wisdom, but to acquire information, then the devotion to the shrine or the form and the adherence to the shrine and the form may come about, but a certain naive approach to the actual path doesn't happen. So then you can label yourself to be a warrior, but not necessarily have the actual qualities of being a warrior. You can then be able to say you are a Mahayanist, practicing to cultivate bodhicitta and engage in embodying the life of a bodhisattva. But at the same time, it may be simply just an idea that you have, an intellectual idea that you have, where the actualization of the practice doesn't happen. So, and often in our cases of many meditators, there are some, of course, who do not fall into such deceptions of the ego and do very well in terms of really bringing together view and action, such that the meditation is used so honestly that the meditation thoroughly and very purely bridges the gap between view and action. So who you are is the view. You do not believe in a view. You're not loyal to a view. You're not loyal or respectful or devoted to Buddha or Buddhism. But you are Buddhism. You are able to embody the bodhisattvahood in your actions of body, speech, and mind. That is then a true practitioner. Now when sometimes this is not understood, then we have, what else are we left with? Sadly, three categories come. One category, the first category is those who then are so sort of hijacked by the ego that they begin to take pleasure in the appearance of being Buddhist. And the entertainment of that, that's extraordinary. Samsaric, mundane entertainment is nothing in comparison to spiritual entertainment. Why so? It's because samsaric entertainment, at least there are some good people who will point out to you, that's not a good thing to do. But when it is then labeled spirituality, especially in this world of social correctness and polite behavior, there's almost nobody who'll be able to say, look, that what you are believing to be spiritual is the biggest deception and destructive force that you are maintaining in your life. Mundane, strong arrogance. As a common man, having arrogance, anger, desire, selfishness, there will be a room full of people who will say, you know, you shouldn't be. Go get help. Sit in meditation. Go and study Buddhism. Now a Buddhist who is arrogant, arrogantly meditating, selfishly sitting, isn't it? Full of desire devoted. Then, even for a teacher, it becomes very difficult. Because that person has enough knowledge to say things like, oh, it's your projection. Isn't it? That's how we say. That's how we shut most people up. Meeting with all these teachers and teachings and communities and practices and methods and learnings, what has the mind understood? That understanding and that realization is the only thing that can ease your encountering of death or suffering or happiness or any subtle and gross experiences, because that will then give you the basis upon which you then have your ideas, your own decisions, and how you relate to situations. So, being careful with this first, not to fall into the category, this very dismal, sort of very unfortunate category that many, many today's practitioners are falling into. Second kind of category, often when you do not know the true essence of the practice, but you go more sort of going into the appearance of the religion or the philosophy rather than working with your own mind, then is sort of shutting your senses and your wisdom down, which are usually what I call naive practitioners. Very sweet, very innocent. Those who go into a garden, see a beautiful flower or a sparrow, write four lines, do a few recitations, breathe a little bit. Yeah. A tonglen here, a tonglen there. Isn't it? And then sort of take a picture, post it on the Facebook, share with the others. That's a nice one. It's very sweet. It's very sweet. It's very, very sweet in that even the very sort of, I think, hardened people, often in the presence of such, find happiness and find hope in basic goodness and patience. So it's very good. But from a perspective of what the Bodhisattva path is trying to teach, the naiveness, no matter how cute, how sweet, how picturesque, still is a place where your potential could stagnate in that innocence. And so the person becomes very sort of starry-eyed about everything. When you begin to see Buddhas and Bodhisattvas everywhere, when you begin to have sense of goodness, but continuously there is the ego, and ultimately it is that point, is that the ego does again raise its head to try and find its nourishment on that naiveness. And upon that very sweet and good-heartedness, it sustains itself. How it sustains itself is there is not much progressiveness. And one of the characteristics that I find in the students in such situations is the sort of almost a laziness comes in, where you do not want to then do anything much more. Learning becomes difficult, doing new things become difficult, analyzing and examining, the critical examination and the challenges of questioning everything becomes dimmed by that naiveness. And so you begin to say, oh, I think I will dwell in this kind of a state of goodness. And the goodness can then become a kind of a cozy nest that you build around your own self. So sustaining that temporarily gives you a temporary benefit, but it is so out of touch with the reality of what ego is and what it is continuously creating. And wherever there is a tendency, even a slight residue of the ego and the ignorance consistently being there, the negativeness and the sort of all the afflictions that we sustain become maybe dormant for a certain time, but not in sort of destroyed. They're not able to be completely subjugated or destroyed. So when an explosion does happen, the explosion comes in the form of utter despair, tremendous hurt, not being able to really find, and most often times, a lot of time goes by where you have allowed yourself to sustain that sense of comfortableness. And so where that comfortableness is maintained, impermanence constantly arises. Physically you age, mentally a lot of sort of non-refinement happens. And because of which, then at certain points when the body begins to have difficulties, you don't know how to handle that. And you find that the responses that you had for others is not the response that you're getting back from the others. Mentally also, you're unable to clearly see why so much negativity is happening. And when such doubt and hesitation arises, you find yourself so stuck in the whirlpool of your own emotions. It's very difficult to find strength and clarity. And where that strength and clarity is very difficult, then the discouragement often comes, and this is how a lot of people seem to then sort of fade out from practice and meditation. A certain, what we call, jadedness comes about. Then, where again, the second kind of a group of people may not happen, then the third, I think, which is the most unfortunate group of people, and that is where the structure and the form of the practices are seen to be so important in their lives that they begin to then have sense of almost fixation, strong fixation and strong attachment to the form of the practices without allowing genuine transcendence, genuine transformation of the mind to happen. And so watching out in one's own mind, because ultimately, when we always say, it's a very fortunate circumstance that we've all had the opportunity to be human beings and have the basic awareness that we can generate and strengthen and make more strong and ever-present, that all of that potential, that very potential, could be defeated, could be completely subdued by these tendencies, despite the fact that you have met with the Dharma, that you do meditate, that you do understand what awakened mind means. So it is with that intention that yesterday we talked a little bit about generating awakened mind. What is awakened mind? So that one is able to explore deeply and more sort of accurately or directly, let's say, the meaning of bodhicitta or awakened mind. So that no naive approach comes, which is, I think, a very big danger. The naive approach, as I just talked about, all the different possibilities that are there. But the naive approach generally can be summed up as a not being able to distinguish between emotionally feeling love and kindness versus what is true bodhicitta, what is true generation of awakened mind.